Hey, everyone. Welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs. I am your host, Katie Harbath. I am bringing to you today a really fascinating conversation with somebody that I've gotten to know quite well over the last couple of years, Kate Klonick. Kate is a professor that teaches property law, internet law, and her research really focuses on law and technology and a lot on private platform governments of online speech. She's done a lot of in-depth work on Facebook's content moderation setups, this creation of the oversight board. She's done a lot of writing on the Supreme Court cases that are happening. And so we go through all of that in our conversation. And so I hope you enjoy. Kate Klonick, welcome to Impossible Trade-Offs.
Thank you for having me.
Before we just get into this and have a wide-ranging conversation that I will be a lot of fun, it'll be like everyone's kind of joining us for a glass of wine or something like that while we're kind of chatting. But can you just share with folks a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Yeah, I am a law professor at St. John's Law School, but most of my work is on internet speech and online speech governance through private platforms. But of course, that means also covering kind of the legal environments that shape those private platforms' ability to govern, which is different in all different places around the world. And so right now I am on a Fulbright in Paris, France, where I am doing work on the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act, which were passed by the EU last year and have gone into effect this year. That's me.
Very cool. I was trying to think about when we first met, because I'm definitely sure I knew of you before I met you in reading some of your work on Facebook.
I'll take that as a compliment, but yes.
Well, I think I do remember, so you mentioned some of your work, you know, has been with platforms and stuff like that. And a part of that has been really documenting from the beginning the creation of the oversight board. And so I feel like that piece that you, I don't know if that's the first one, but I was trying to rack my brain today. Yeah, when we actually met face to face.
I think that it might have been at the Atlantic Council event in Brussels. But I'd also seen you and heard about you at that point, because I think that, you know, it's a small world that does this type of stuff, and the good people kind of make themselves known pretty quickly. And that was like your reputation. But yes, the work that I have done, the two things that I think that probably I'm better known for is a piece called The New Governors that was published in 2018 in the Harvard Law Review. It was one of the first very detailed inside the platform's descriptions of the process of content moderation, which had kind of been a little bit theoretical or talked about in dribs and drabs from a very kind of top-down perspective of leadership, like of people who had been faced with making these decisions, but not the operation side of it. And so that was a piece that came out in 2018 and kind of ended up being kind of foundational for the field. It just was a thing that people could cite to. I think it became, you know, that laid out the fundamentals, and that was like very much needed at the time. And then shortly thereafter, of course, like the field really blew up. And around 2019, and the oversight board started to kind of get moving. Facebook announced that they were going to do this oversight board. And, you know, it's like, if you're interested in really creating multi-stakeholder accountable transparency regime, like, wouldn't it be good to have someone watching you as you did it? It's like kind of a rapporteur, like a fly on the wall. And they were like, yeah, that would be like a good idea. And so I wrote a law review article on that for the Law Journal, and then did a popular press piece for The New Yorker, and did an accompanying Radiolab episode. Those projects were kind of some of the things that my larger kind of empirical qualitative work that then got turned into academic and popular press writing.
I forgot about The New Governors coming before the oversight board stuff. And that, like you said, that was one of the first real pieces or work that almost like kind of pulled back the curtain a little bit of the black box that was happening inside the company. I'm curious the process for you of writing that. Were there things that surprised you when you got into the belly of the beast and you saw how we were trying to deal with these issues?
Yeah. So, I mean, just for people's background, I have a JD, and I also was a journalist after graduating from college for a long time. So I have like this background in journalism and qualitative review, but then I also have a PhD in law, and I was in the process of doing my PhD, and I was at Yale Law School doing that. And I was thought I was going to be working on IP, intellectual property and copyright. And what I was really interested in was whether or not, if this was in 2015, whether or not the companies were doing any more adjudication on notice and takedown regimes in copyright. Like, are they, is there any type of, how is this being reviewed? Like, and it turned out that actually that was the most boring question because there really isn't anything. It is exactly, it's all in the name. It's notice and it's takedown. There's really not much more going on there. So that was not that interesting. But I was talking to someone at an event in New York. And I was mentioning that I was interested in this project. And they're like, well, you'd be really interested in content moderation. And, you know, if you want to do that, you should talk to Dave and Charlotte Wilner. They're really like the people to talk to. And it's really hard to remember how quickly this all changed, Katie. Because, I mean, in 2015, we're talking pre-Trump. I had to start every conversation when I told people what I was working on with, you might not realize it, but everything you post online doesn't necessarily stay there. Like, they have all of these secret rules that they're applying. They were very secret at that time, especially at Facebook. And, you know, there was a lot of theory around it and no one had tried to kind of do this qualitative work. And I just started making calls. I just started like bugging people. And there had been a few articles. I mean, I don't want to act like I like invented this field or something. That's far from it. There are lots and lots of people who are doing this beforehand. Rebecca McKinnon had talked about it in her book, Consent of the Network. There was Jeff Rosen had written a lot about it. Two stories, for one for the New York Times Magazine, one from the New Republic about this. But it had like, I think that there was a moment in which there was people just didn't realize really what it meant. I think that he was like almost too early a little bit. Like, it was like people were not really fully understanding what it meant to have takedowns and what it meant to be like, they weren't taking the social media platform super seriously as vectors for the public square, as vectors for democracy. It was still like a stupid thing that kids were doing a little bit. And by 2015, and especially by 2016, that had all changed. And so the work that I was doing and starting to do these interviews, I just, the really other pivotal thing was that I agreed with all of my sources, I was going to anonymize them. So they still had NDAs. And by the time kind of I wrapped up writing about it, it had been a year of like completing interviews, and most of the NDAs had expired. They were like 3 or 4 years out of the company at that point, the people that I talked to. And so there was like, okay, well, like maybe we'll put our names to this. And I think that that was also a huge part of it. So I really like, I just, it was just, honestly, it was very good luck. I kind of just hit the area at the right time and had the right set of skills to kind of tell the tale. And then of course, like everything happened with the elections and here we are. Now everyone knows, I mean, like the New York Times has like 6 reporters doing content moderation. Content moderation is this term of art that like no one knew existed until, you know, until 2018, I would say, like really. And it's just been a fast 6 years at this point.
I know it is kind of mind-boggling to think about. Like for me, the date when it all really changed, though we didn't necessarily know it at the time, was that December post in 2015 by Trump about the Muslim ban.
Yes, I remember
like,
that.
Like I was scuba diving in Roatan, and I was between two dives, and I pull up my phone and I see like a message from somebody at Facebook about the post, and all I remember is like messaging somebody on my team being like, "Make sure nobody takes this down without it being escalated within the company. Before you do so, I have to go on my second dive." And the entire second dive, I'm like, I don't know what we're gonna do, and I wasn't in the room for the conversation on it, but that's where it's like, it was just very much thrust to the forefront in one of the most complicated ways that you could have it. We had issues before that, especially with conservatives and other things like that. But this is the one where all of a sudden the press and everyone's starting to pay attention of like, holy smokes.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that one of the things that in doing all of these interviews with people who've worked inside the company is doing content moderation and trust and safety work. One of the things that I hear very frequently is that there are like certain world events that have been very significant inflection points. And it's very much like a periodic evolution, I think, of like these moments, these specific moments that have meant that there are huge changes in either public awareness and then public pressure around what the policies are, but then also just actually before there was the public pressure, that they were inflection points internally for the companies and what they were doing. So one of the things that I hear from everyone, from people at Twitter, to people at YouTube. And I think this is really significant for Facebook, because this was a moment that Sheryl Sandberg became involved in a decision which she normally didn't kind of get her hands dirty in the trust and safety world on a very regular basis at that point, but was the Boston Marathon bombing. And that is like a huge moment in which the Boston Globe had published on the front page a picture of a man's leg blown off below the knee. And it had violated the Facebook rule of no insides on the outsides in terms of graphic content, which is always a rule who's like, I really love a rule that just like tells you how to apply it in the title. But, you know, they had taken down a front page headline of a current event, of like a newsworthy event. And Sheryl insisted it go back up. And they were like, we can't make exceptions for current events and newsworthiness. If we did that, we'd have these beheadings on the platform from the Mexican cartels beheading people. Violence, a lot of violence is a newsworthy event, and we don't put it on our front page, even if it's published in a newspaper. And we can't make an American exception for something that, just because we all know people in Boston and you went to school there, like, doesn't mean that, like, you know, that we can make it's not on the Yucatan Peninsula, doesn't mean that, like, there's that we can make a different rule. And, you know, but of course that is what it means. So, like, you can make a different rule if you're in charge, which is one of the things that, you know, you and I talk about and work on all the time, is like trying to enable other players and other stakeholders in all of this.
I'll never forget a conversation we had on election policies. I think it was like 2018. And we were talking about, because there's a lot of pressure on the company, right, to have policies around voter suppression or not having posts up that encourage people not to vote. And there was a point in time where it was going to be, you know, it's not the proverbial, you know, hammer comes down and it's decreed across all the land. But that is a little bit of what it's like. A decision happens and it goes out across the land that this is the new law and you must apply it. And I remember jumping up and being like, we can't do this globally, because there have been examples. There was a Romanian referendum on gay marriage where it wouldn't have passed if not enough people showed up to vote, and they knew they weren't going to win it. And so their whole process was to, or their plan was to tell people not to go vote in the referendum so they didn't hit quorum. And it's a super edge case in thinking about this, but like, I was like, you can't do this carte blanche around the world. And I was like, I don't know if we should just make an American exception. We did. A lot of these companies have, and it's something that I think is not talked about enough, about the nuances of any of these policies. And you start to twist yourself up into a pretzel to try to fit the cultural moment of the time, but that doesn't work really great at scale.
Yeah. I mean, and Nicole Wong, who was at Google and doing this stuff, and the head of the decider, as Jeff Rosen called her, at Google doing this stuff in the early 2000s, talks about the videos that were leaked of Saddam Hussein's dead body. You know, God, if that's not new, you know, there isn't like some type of newsworthiness in that, and the actual hanging and like what they decided and how they made the calls about that. I mean, so I think it's really interesting that there are these kind of high profile moments that are slightly different across platforms, depending on the medium and depending on what kind of happens. But, you know, you tell that story of kind of the Trump Muslim ban, and there's, you know, and I am, you know, I think of Philando Castile or the Cleveland murder, where they live streamed a murder on Facebook Live. I mean, all of these things were happening around 2015, 2016, and that's really when these conversations took off. And I think that there's a simultaneous thing that happened, which was that there was just a real market saturation of smartphones at that point. And unlimited data plans that allowed people to like just constantly stream or post or do or consume media. And so all of a sudden, there just was a lot more content, and the salience of the content became kind of much more important, which is, you know, I think only more true as like in consequential years of elections like this one.
Yeah, and I think it was not just, you know, I think you made a great point about the smartphones, but it was also this rise of video and how much harder it is to build classifiers and do detection of video, but also just of live video, you know, because that's where you had like the Christchurch shooting and the challenges around that and what that looks like. And so there was this expectation that people had that, you know, maybe these companies need to be proactively finding this, but there are challenges in which to do that. Shifting, I want to shift over to then your conversations about the oversight board and setting this up, because a part of that comes out of these content moderation conversations where Mark is basically like, I don't like you all don't want me being the one making these decisions. I don't want to be the one making these decisions. I know. Let's set up a panel of people that will have to make these decisions. And kind of in typical Facebook fashion, it was something that was announced and then it was figured out later of how to actually do
poor
this.
Facebook comms. Poor Facebook comms. That's a
I know.
Thankless job right there. Yeah.
I always tell folks, I'm like, it's, you know, a lot of times people are like, how can that be their comms strategy? And I go, you got to understand, like, there's a lot more people involved in comms than there is just the comms. If they listened to just the comms team, it would be a very different situation than, totally. You know, what folks in California are deciding that they want to do. The number of times I woke up and I was like, oh, I guess we're doing this now. Okay. We'll go. I have a meeting on my calendar and it's like, all right, our goal is to figure out how we're going to make this happen. But anyways, curious for you to go a little bit deeper into your reporting on that, your research on that, and sort of, were there things that surprised you throughout the process and how did it go overall for you? Because if I remember right, when you published the story, it was actually quite controversial in academic circles.
Yeah, it was a little controversial. I don't want to like, I mean, I...
You don't have to relive it.
No, it's fine. I mean, there's just, it's been a very, it's, you know, I feel, you know, this could be an epistemological conversation for a different day, but there is a, you know, I really like to think that my work is very descriptive. It's actually something that like I get a lot of flack for as a legal academic, because legal academics are kind of supposed to make arguments and say how things should be, or what the best way to move forward is. And the work I like to do is like to just kind of point out the worst parts of certain types of regimes as they currently are, like organizations as they currently are laid out, or power structures, and then just kind of like, you know, be like, this is how it all works. So like, let's think of a better solution to this or figure out what's wrong. But without that piece was, I really had no role in advising or consulting, or I mean, not really had no role. I had no role like explicitly in like advising or consulting or setting it up. I just kind of watched and asked questions about what they were doing. And so that was fascinating. And I think that a lot of people thought that I was legitimizing big tech by doing this. I think that that was like very much I was legitimizing this by writing up this kind of this board in this way. But honestly, like, I mean, I just don't know how you win in an argument like that. It's just kind of like, so what am I supposed to, like, we're just supposed to act like this isn't happening, like, you know. And the tech lash at that point was just at such a fever pitch that like there was also, you know, I had really insulated myself because I'd taken no money from the platforms ever for anything. And so I was saved from some of this, but like other people had taken like a $10,000 grant for something here or done a little bit of consulting or something. And like it had just poisoned the well for them on all types of things. So anyways, the oversight board, it ended up being kind of, I did like every 2 weeks would go back to San Francisco, back to Menlo Park, and meet with the team. And it was a cross-function team that was building out the oversight board. And, you know, this couldn't just spring, as Elliot said, that like Mark just announced and they figured it out later. But like, there was also a little bit of like, there was a little bit of strategy in that, like, they knew that this couldn't just spring from the head of Mark, that if they were going to get buy-in and have legitimacy, they needed to go and kind of talk to people and have listening sessions and do and like figure out what this was going to look like and what who should be involved and how it should be reviewed and what types of considerations it should take into account. And so, you know, I went to a couple of, they had huge stakeholder meetings around the world. And I went to those and they kind of asked people questions and surveyed people about what they thought, like who should be on the board, what type of law should it take into consideration? Should it take law into consideration? You know, what will, you know, what types of questions will they take? Will it be direct appeal? All of these types of kind of, institutional setup issues, but also kind of legal procedural issues. And then some of like the substantive law of like, how is this going to be figured out? And going and doing that was fascinating because there was like a fair amount of consensus about how things should look. Like the international human rights law was a huge push for that to be like the standard, outside standard, besides the community standards that Facebook had, to for that to be one of the ways in which the board considered like these decisions. And then, you know, other parts were kind of just fascinating from a human element. Like lawyers thought that the board should all be full of lawyers. You know, academics thought it should be academics. Civil society people were like, it should be a board full of civil society people. International human rights people were like, it should be all international human rights
lawyers. We all have our bubbles.
Exactly. And then like, you know, and you know, and so there was kind of the diversity was a big problem, like how you actually build a globally diverse board. Of course, it can't be. And, you know, so it was all just fascinating from an institutional perspective of how you set something like this up and how you build it. And so that was kind of going, you know, going to those meetings and then going to see the team, and they would kind of present their work to me, and I would just poke at it and ask a lot of questions and be like, are you considering this? Have you considered this? And did you consider this? And, you know, and they would go through and kind of talk it all out. But I do think that one of the things I didn't focus on and I really was not interested in was really the high level. I think a lot of attention gets paid to the C-suite in a lot of these decisions. I think, you know, that's where Kara Swisher has all of her sources. That's where Walter Isaacson, like, you know, there's going to be Stephen Levy, like the journalists, that's like, they tell the story of Sam Altman. They tell the story of like the big fancy wunderkinds. And like, I actually kind of think that the most interesting stuff happens in the weeds and in the operation systems and the day-to-day and the people who are not making the big decisions. I mean, I understand that the big change happens because, you know, Mark removed all the layers between him and the head of the project, right? And so that was like, I understand how all of this works, but I do think that this is... it was a great moment to kind of be able to see that kind of thing take place. And it was, you know, it's a crazy boondoggle, insane experiment. Facebook Supreme Court, it sounds so bleh. But, you know, when one of the things that, you know, happens if you put serious people on a board and you give it funding and you have it issue decisions is like it actually starts to have legitimacy and it starts to actually be taken seriously. And now you see, you know, the decisions quoted in international human rights law, they become custom, they become kind of really important in how places are thinking about setting up new systems under rules of law. And so, I don't know, I think that that was just a fascinating thing to be a part of.
And other companies are piggybacking off the decisions too. Like I've talked to many trust and safety people that work at other platforms that they're like, they pay attention to what comes down and they may not, you know, it may not exactly apply to them, but like it is, as you were saying all this, I was just sitting here being like, we still are still so close to everything that has happened and changed in such a quick period of time that it's been really hard because we're still living it to zoom out to really understand what the full impact of a lot of these things are and what they've impacted in other ways, especially when right now we also have an actual Supreme Court that is making decisions on this. And so maybe that's a good shift over to some of those cases, because you have been writing a lot about particularly Murphy v. Missouri, but also Net Choice and these other cases. Maybe to start, can you, just in case listeners aren't familiar, can you maybe give a little bit of a primer of some of the cases that the court is considering at the moment?
Sure. I think the first thing to say is just like content moderation just kind of like all of a sudden had its moment in the public eye. It is all of a sudden had its moment in the courts. There were very few, almost none. There's like one exception, I think Packingham versus North Carolina in 2015 that didn't issue like really a particularly precedential decision. But before that, the last kind of internet law case that was heard was Reno versus ACLU in 1997. And so all of a sudden, there was a case called Knight v. Biden, which was actually originally Knight v. Trump, which was the Knight Institute, First Amendment Institute at Columbia had sued to basically that Trump had violated the First Amendment by blocking accounts on Twitter. And it was successful. They won that case on the Second Circuit. It went to the Supreme Court, and then it was moot because Trump was no longer president. In mooting it and saying that they weren't going to take it take the case, Clarence Thomas wrote this kind of like this little concurrence that kind of said, but we would love to take some internet law cases. Like, please do. Like, you know, and it was like I'm not a huge fan of justices soliciting the types of cases that they want to take. So this was very annoying to me. And also I think like untoward, but it's, you know, it's within bounds, I guess, technically they can do what they want. And so unsurprisingly, the last 2 years have been filled with like internet law cases out of the blue, and everyone I know who writes and works in this area has just been like, it's been a constant five-alarm fire. The first, which was really a surprise, was the Gonzalez and Tomna cases, which were Section 230 and then an aiding and abetting under the Terrorism Act kind of questions. And those were really bizarre and bad fact patterns. I won't like get into it, but they seemed imprudently granted. They had imprudently granted cert to these cases, and the justices in oral arguments sounded like they were like, "Why did we select this case? Why are you here? This isn't particularly ripe. This isn't like a particularly novel question." And so that had been like Gonzalez in particular had been set to kind of like possibly get rid of Section 230, and they decided not to do that. And so it kind of was like a very, for those of us who kind of think that Section 230 as it is and like whatever the court was going to do with it would have been a disaster, was really quite relieved when that ended up, you know, they ended up kind of just affirming the lower court case and not writing very much at all. But then simultaneously, Texas and Florida had passed a version of a must carry laws, which meant that, you know, content moderation on socials was going to be, and it wasn't even clear it was just socials. That was one of the problems with Florida's law. It looked like it was like all websites. So, you know, so everything from an app to a website, like all of these things that you weren't going to be able to do content moderation for, which was, you know, seemingly in violation of the platform's own First Amendment rights to kind of curate or editorialize the platforms as they want to do, as they want to address them under the First Amendment. And so those cases, the Texas and Florida cases, are called collectively the NetChoice cases, because NetChoice, the trade association for a lot of the social media companies, brought these claims against Florida and Texas AGs, and just was argued in front of the Supreme Court. So that's not a 230 case, that's a First Amendment case. One of the main things that you saw the justices kind of struggling with there was to how to basically think of platforms and to think of websites, and just really struggling between like, well, is it a shopping mall, or is it a train, or is it a newspaper, or is it a bookstore? And kind of like all of those things, by the way, are existing First Amendment cases that have certain types of that have like certain types of outcomes that would be dictated if that's the analogy that they found that fit. And of course, the answer is that like the internet is all of those things. And so, and it's quite difficult. And I think that therein kind of is like, well, hopefully inform the answer with that these laws are overbroad and in violation of the First Amendment, and they will be struck down. But while we were waiting for that one, then there was the Murthy v. Missouri case, which was the Louisiana and the Missouri state AGs bringing a claim against the members of the Biden administration for, you know, what is called the term of art is jawboning, which was essentially the members of the government and administration calling up the platforms and saying, oh my gosh, you have this misinformation about COVID on your website, on Twitter, like what, take this down. And that had, you know, really, they had forum shopped that case to the hilt. That was really not particularly novel or interesting legal issues. It was a very political case. It was put in front of a Trump-appointed judge in Western District, Louisiana. It then gets appealed up to the Fifth Circuit, which is very, very conservative right now and very kind of radical. And so it was affirmed and kind of landed in the Supreme Court, and with just a really, really kind of that I can't emphasize strongly enough how terrible the underlying district court opinion was. I mean, just terribly written. I mean, it just like from a legal standpoint, it like made more reference to like George Orwell than it made to any type of First Amendment law. I mean, that's just like, it was just kind of, and the findings of fact were not significant. Didn't rise to any of the levels. And the justices, you know, gratefully in the oral arguments really said so, and really kind of read the Louisiana state AG, the Riot Act, or the Solicitor General, excuse me, the Riot Act. And that was refreshing. So that one hopefully will be resolved like well. And then there have just been like little cases, like does employee speech on Facebook count as employee speech or does it count as personal speech? You know, what are, you know, there's all of these little cases that have been percolating that are kind of tangential to online speech considerations. It's just been a fire hose. And then simultaneously in Europe, you have the DSA and the DMA, the Digital Services Act and the Digital Markets Act. And so it's just,
you've been keeping busy.
Yeah. It's just been a never ending stream. And it's really hard to figure out where to focus your energy, honestly. So,
yeah, I know it's fascinating times to be alive and trying to also kind of connect the dots. And I find it really hard with all, I've been using a kaleidoscope as my metaphor for where we are right now, because you turn the dial just a little bit and the picture could change of how things might turn out. And so then when I'm talking to, it could be reporters, civil society, like name the person, like yesterday I had two conversations where people were like, it was policymakers and like some others in civil society. And they're like, if you could wave a magic wand to fix the internet, what would you do? And I was like, oh my God, you needed to prep me a little bit more for that question before I could like go into this, because, you know, there's not only then what you were talking about in Europe, but then there's, you know, these laws in places like India, where there's, you know, they want to have pre-approval of, well, they wanted to have pre-approval of AI models, but there's a lot of stuff around government speech that they want to be able to leave up. We've got Elon Musk right now fighting the Brazil Supreme Court that's happening. And so, yeah, it's a lot. And how do you connect all the dots?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the benefits of having a little bit of an academic approach to this, is just like, I've read all the literature that's been written over the last 25 years. And it's interesting whose theories, you know, have been proven to be right. And there is a tremendous book by Harvard Law Professor Jack Goldsmith and Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu, who's famously of the attention merchants and the master switch. And I think this is like kind of Tim Wu in a different life, because I don't know how he doesn't focus on the internet as in this way anymore. But the idea was basically that it was called Who Controls the Internet, and 2006, I think it came out. And it's basically Jack and Tim make this argument that, you know, that is, we're just going to see global geopolitics like recapitulated online. Like the internet is just going to become a new like stage of political brokering, of economic of economic coercion, of kind of regulatory arbitrage, of kind of lawfare, warfare types of things. And I just, you know, it's really interesting. I don't think for a long time it looked like that was happening, because just people weren't actually regulating. And then in the last 5 years, that has been, I would just say, I just like that has it has been that on steroids. Like everyone and their brother, like every state is like coming up with their, and now it's in the United States because of the lack of like our broken Congress and our inability to regulate anything at the federal level. People are using the courts and they're using the agencies and they're using the states. The states can pass a lot of really crappy laws, and so that's what they're doing, and you know. And it's just I do have to say that like I am pro smart regulation for the companies, and particularly things that will hold them accountable. But I have to say that in this particular moment, in the US, like I do not know that I would be making the bet of regulating the tech companies more and driving the state and the platforms closer together. And I guess what I mean by this is like, there are a lot of laws that have not been enforced for a long time that because of Dobbs and because of other types of decisions that have come down, we are suddenly in the business, the states and different, you know, are suddenly in the business of enforcing. And there's a lot of moments in which we want the platforms to stand up for individual liberties against these demands for like these subpoenas, or against turning over all of your DMs with your best friend about your unplanned pregnancy or what have you. And like, I just don't know that the bet that I would be making right now, even though I really think of myself as a person on the left, the bet that I would make right now is I'm worried, let's not tie the progressive hands from future lawmaking. Let's leave the option open. I'm more concerned about fascists having control of all of our data and all of our ability to speak to each other and all of our ability to organize and publicly participate. And yeah, that's where I'm feeling right now. And I wonder what you're thinking going into elections. Is that also your concern?
Yeah. I mean, I was just reading Foreign Policy magazine. Their entire issue this time around now is about, it's the India issue. And I've been fascinated with India since the first election that I worked there was when Modi came to power in 2014, and how much he used digital. And they were kind of talking about how there's these very popular leaders in Asia, whether it is the new president of Indonesia, you know, Modi, even, you know, in the Philippines, and a lot of them. One of the trends Foreign Policy was talking about yesterday was just like how much they really did embrace online somewhat a lot earlier than others did. And they have figured out how to use it to their own ends of being able to stay in power and to stay popular. And one of the things that I talk a lot about with Americans and almost also kind of frustrates me, because every conversation I have with an American philanthropist or think tank or something like that, my first question has to be, are you focused globally or just on the US? And most of the time they're like, just US. And I'm like, okay, I just want to let you know though, that what happens here in the US is going to impact how other countries act elsewhere around the world. So you really don't have that luxury of just thinking about what is happening here. And we have these whole host of elections coming up here at the end of May, beginning of June. So South Africa, the end of the Indian elections, Mexico, and the European Parliament will all be in a 12-day period, which I just then gives me great anxiety about for the poor people inside the companies who have to try to go through all of those in that period of time. But to your point about, we were talking about earlier, where there are major moments that become defining ones of how companies handle these crisis moments and how they manifest themselves. And, you know, a lot right now is focused on AI, but there's a lot of other issues too. And I think a lot about how there's a lot of newer companies. It could be your TikToks, your Discords, your Twitches, others, where they're building these tools for the new time, but they're also, and their senior leadership, it's the first time they're going to have to make some of these decisions in real time. And I worry that they haven't done enough red teaming and putting themselves in those positions of thinking through some of these borderline, these edge cases, these types of things that might come up that they are going to be confronted with at like in the middle of the night and be pressured to make a decision right away. And it's going to be things that we look back on that like is going to catapult us potentially into the next age of what it looks like to do. And I like to broaden it out beyond just content moderation, but to just trust and safety in general, because there's so many different, you know, the behavior, what people are doing, how the content's distributed, stuff like that, that might come up. So yeah, a lot, you know, this is why my theme for this year is panic responsibly. Is to try to keep calm amongst the storm.
Well, I mean, it's been 8 years since 2016. And I think this is a good story to
God,
tell.
God, I think I've aged 24.
I know. Years. It's been 8 years since 2016. I will never forget that there was a closed door meeting held at Yale Law School and part of the ISP, and it was Chatham House rule, so I can't like talk about who was there or anything else, except I will say that a lot of general counsel for newspapers and media companies were in this room, and people who had like were experts in kind of internet policy and internet law following the November election, basically to be like to about the fear of fake news. This is like this thing that had happened. I mean, if you the weeks after like 2016 were very much like, how could this have happened? And the finger went to social media and kind of their failure to police these types of things. And first of all, I want you to know, like, think about that. Like, why the hell were the general counsel of like all of these like crazy large dead tree newspapers in a room to talk about fake news. Well, because like people thought that the best, like the biggest problem to fake news, or like the biggest thing that you could do to fight fake news was real news, and funding real news. Like that was like a real, like, and then there was also just like a lack of information. The people just were using this term and didn't really know what it meant. People didn't know like the difference between dis and misinformation. And I want to say that this has changed wildly, but it has not. I still
The New York Times the other week was talking about Chinese information ops and saying misinformation.
Yes. Yes.
In a subhead.
And I'm literally like, I can't believe that it has been 8 years and people use mis and disinfo in like that phrase, mis and disinfo. Like it, they mean the same thing. Like this is not, these are not at all equivalent problems. Okay. I'm going to just, I mean, your reader or your listeners know this already, but like disinfo is coordinated into inauthentic behavior. The way you go after that is by looking at the behavior of users and profiles, and you target it the way you target spam. And I, you know, and this is, you know, in a lot of ways, that is how they do this, right? And they build classifiers that identify certain types of like certain types of behavior, and they can police this fairly easily, based on kind of on just, you know, a lot of the techniques that you've developed around cybersecurity. Honestly, misinformation is everything. Like a Seinfeld episode in the wrong context is misinformation. Like a fairy tale in the wrong, like in the wrong kind of context, or a play is like misinformation. And it's also parody. It can be satire. It can be plenty of things that we want to kind of to kind of put out there. But it, of course, it can be like terrible political conspiracy theories and all of these types of things. It is an insanely contextual, and constitutionally protected, by the way, under the First Amendment. Difficult thing to police or understand. And the idea that people talk about these things in the same like four syllables in 8 years after we've been dealing with this, like, I'm just kind of like, have we learned anything? Can we stop? And it's like,
it feels like a hamster wheel.
It
and
does.
We just keep on the same hamster wheel over and over and over again. And it hasn't evolved. And like, and then we like, and this is my rant about AI, is all these apocalyptic headlines about what AI could do. And yes, we need to be worried about it, but like, we're not awash in like AI. Like, you know, they use these, the tsunami, we're going to be drowned in it. Like, these things are all happening. And that's just adding to the fear that people have. And I'm quite frustrated that I realized the other day, there's really no media critics left. You don't have a lot of those folks to hold even the broader news industry accountable for how they are covering this and their own role that they are playing as part of this. And I feel like we don't talk about that enough, that they are just as part of needing to think about how we cover these types of things as much as the social media companies, civil society, government, and everyone.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely true. Like, everyone is a media critic, Katie. That's where the media critics are. Everyone is a media critic.
Yeah.
There's New York Times PitchBot. Come on, it's a great Twitter account. Like, you know, like, but there.
Okay, that's very fair.
But
there's Jeff Jarvis doing his goals on Twitter and Threads. Yeah.
Yeah, but I do think that to your point, there's there isn't there's not a silo for it, and it is kind of diverse. And also, like, I think that it really depends. There's a lot of I think that media consumption is very is obviously very politically based now, and it's kind of seen as an extension of kind of tribal politics. Of where you get your news from, where you read, like who you defend, what you think is the right perspective. I am just kind of frustrated in general at I thought that we'd be a little bit farther along at this point.
Before I let you go, I do want to talk about a piece of yours that I think I have quoted ad nauseum about the end of the golden age of tech accountability. Back in actually March of 23, so a little over a year ago, we were in New York for an All Tech is Human event. And you were talking about, you know, was 2021 in respect to heyday for trust and safety online. Can you share a bit more about your theory here? And I'm curious how you think it's holding up a year later.
Yeah. So if you can remember back this far and separate all of your crisis moments and tech out, this was kind of brought around like the, all the tech layoffs were happening. And so there was just like a huge amount of layoffs happening. The Elon deal had gone through and the Twitter trust and safety team had been dismantled. So that was kind of the moment that I wrote this piece in. And the main kind of takeaway, I guess, was that I was trying to argue that like when the companies were doing well, and there was this kind of, do the right thing type of attitude of caring about what the reputational costs of the company were for their end goals and their market shares, there had been all of this very self-regulatory, like, incentive to create multi-stakeholder bodies to engage with the community. And whether or not they did anything is questionable, but at least there were like efforts and to work with researchers and to do things. And you could criticize them all you want, but this was kind of like, at least these things were existing. Jigsaw had like, you know, an entire research center that they worked with like academics on researching all of these issues, like, you know, on and on. Like this was like, they, you know, the oversight board is maybe a really high watermark of that $300 million to set up, you know, this multi-stakeholder body to hold the tech company self-regulatory wise, anyways, semi-responsible. And so I guess what you had seen was that, you know, there was all of this cutting of workers in 2023 and this like kind of like budgetary crisis. And the first thing to go was all of these kind of like, you know, the ESG stuff, the environment, the acts, like the social stuff and the governmental kind of governance type of modalities that they had kind of engaged in for a while. And so, you know, I think that there was, I guess to say as like a collective group, like there had been not enough work done fast enough to make sure that those types of guardrails had gotten set out either by a legal authority of some kind, by mandating them or some kind, or just like diplomacy and trying to ensure that they continue to exist. And I just kind of, I was like looking back and I was like, wow, we complained about 2021. I don't know if there was a greater year for the tech lash than 2020 and 2021. Which is weird because we all like were so reliant on it during that period of time. And also, I don't know that that will ever hit that high watermark again of like the number of people that the companies were putting into doing this type of trust and safety work and participating with researchers and talking to governments and, you know, and doing these types of things. You know, I think that unfortunately, like Twitter created a really terrible experiment of like, well, maybe we can just throw away our trust and safety teams and this product still goes. I mean, it doesn't really still go. It's a completely different product and it's like nowhere near as like, you know, usable as it was or as beneficial as it was a number of years ago. But, it, you know, around the edges, it still works. Yeah. So that was kind of that piece. And I think that it resonated with a lot of people because also inside the companies, a lot of people had decided not to work in research and to go into the companies and try to make them better from the inside out and had, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of getting screamed at Thanksgiving tables by like their relatives of like, how can you work for such an evil company? How can you work for Facebook? And how can you work for Twitter? How can you work for these, you know, how can you work for Google? Like,
I literally had to write talking points for people every Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
About, I mean, like how to deal with the questions you were going to get from your friends and family when you went home to Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I think that piece kind of had a lot of salience. And I think it's been true. Unfortunately, I do think that the next few years, we're just going to continue to kind of see diminished resources in this area.
The only thing I could see it, and I think you're right, in the next few years, I will be curious to see in the next, let's say 5 to 7, or maybe we'll use 8 for a nice round number, as more regulation does come down and they do have to start complying with it a bit more, would that mean that you start seeing increases again? So it's not from the self-regulatory side, but from the regulatory side. But Kate, we will leave it here. Thank you so much for taking this time and chatting with us. us. I always love talking to you, and I can't thank you enough for your support. And I think a big thing, I'll just speak personally about that piece and other things that you've done, is you have given voice and helping people who are doing this work inside the companies feel seen for the stuff that they are trying to do, when oftentimes elsewhere in the public eye and stuff like that, that's oftentimes not seen, or it's thinking that they're not doing that. And there's nothing more demoralizing than seeing headlines and stuff of being like people thinking this work is not happening when folks are inside actually trying to do it. And the truth is somewhere in the middle, because there's definitely challenges and pullbacks from it. But other than X, who I put in its own category, all of its own, there are still, and they also still have people, although they're just now a safety team, because apparently for Elon, trust means censorship. But thank you so much for joining me. And I will put links to everything that you mentioned in the show notes.
Thank you so much, Katie. This is awesome.
Thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Impossible Trade-Offs. You can find the show notes and everything for this podcast on my Substack at anchorchange.substack.com. I want to thank my guests for doing this, and this episode was edited by Claude Jennings Jr. I hope you all have a great day, and thank you so much.